Call the Judiciary Committee meeting to order. It's 1:36 on Monday morning, Monday afternoon. That's, it feels like morning to me still, with Senator Olson.
Yes, Chair.
Senator Dyson, Senator McGuire, and Chair Coghill here today. My expectation is we'll have Senator Wilkowski join us in a little bit. So the order for those listening in today and in committee room, my plan today is to take Senate Bill 200, which Senator McGuire has sponsored, and I'd like for her to give the introduction and any professional or public testimony you want to give. My expectation is somewhere around 2 o'clock or a little shortly after that to allow Senate Bill 176 to come up, and I know it's generated a lot of people who want to testify on it,
Excellent.
Both pro and con. So we'll try to get them to give us their time. We'll respect their time as much as we can. For Senate Bill 200, by the way, you have one person online, so just let me know when you're ready.
Okay.
So Senate Bill 200. Senator McGuire.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. Well, this is a really important bill to complete the statutes under Alaska law. A member of this committee, Senator Dyson, passed a bill back in 2006. I voted for it, and I know you did too, Mr. Chairman, which created criminal liability for the death of an unborn child. And it rounded out our statutes to ensure that when you had a mother who was the victim of a crime or any other unlawful or negligent actions that was pregnant, that unborn child would also be deemed a victim, and that there could be a charge against someone who would have perpetrated that unlawful action, that crime. So if you had a murder, if you had, for example, a DUI, we'd had a series of cases like that were happening in Alaska where a mother, pregnant mothers were being hit by people who were driving under the influence of alcohol, killing a pregnant mother and her unborn child, but only the mother, the person was only being charged with killing the mother. What we didn't do at that time, though, and that other states have done, we're one of only 10 states, in fact, that currently have this gap in the law, is we did not at the time allow civil law recovery. And so Senate Bill 200 would complete Alaska's statute to allow for civil recovery for unlawful or negligent actions against those who take unlawful or negligent actions against an unborn child. And that's the very simple part of the bill. When you look at Title 9, 915.018, we are adding to it an action for a wrongful death of an unborn child. And again, we're making it very clear that it's an unlawful or negligent action, that it is an unborn child. And we're giving parents a path toward healing. Obviously, nothing. A lot of the people that have contacted our offices, you know, they've shared their stories with us. They're awful, gut-wrenching stories, and we understand that in allowing for civil recovery in court in Alaska, that nothing will bring back the loss of that child in these awful circumstances. Some of them have been under criminal circumstances. And as you know, Mr. Chairman, what we deal with in Judiciary Committee is oftentimes you will have a criminal case where the victims feel some sense of justice, and sometimes you don't, frankly. Sometimes the path to justice actually comes about better through a civil remedy, but oftentimes a family will feel some better sense of justice by going through both avenues. And that's why we do have a civil and a criminal system. And so the families that have contacted us feel that they want an opportunity. If there's a murder, a manslaughter, a criminally negligent homicide of their unborn child, to have that opportunity to tell their story and to get recourse. They know it won't ever bring that child back, but it's an opportunity also when you think about some of the things that are, you know, the goals that we have in society for deterrence. Mm-hmm. If you do have a case where you've got someone who is a repeat drunk driver that's out there driving on the streets, the opportunity for that person to face justice for not only killing the mother but that unborn child, that life that will never ever get a chance to be born out, to recognize that. That's much more serious than having just killed the mother, obviously. That person who comes into a shopping mall and shoots, again, not just the woman, but that unborn child. In some cases, we've heard from families where the woman was just a few weeks away from giving birth to that really happy life, that moment that was supposed to be a celebration, and now is just a time of just tremendous grief that can never, ever be replaced. So that's what the bill does. In short, and I appreciate the committee's opportunity. I'd be happy to answer any questions, and we do have some folks online I know that are here to testify, and then I'm happy to answer any questions.
So is there any questions at this point? Just one for me, and that is, what is the general, for those who are in the room, what is the general level of proof scrutiny that something like this would require?
So the general level of proof is recognized under the civil statutes, and I can pull it out for you. But
just as a question, I'll right. before we make any motion on the bill, I want to make sure.
Okay, and what it'll be is the mental intent will be that of intentional action, negligence. And then, of course, in the area of wrongful death. So I'll bring up all three of those.
Thank you. Thank you. Well, we do have some people to testify today, and so, and I don't know if anybody in the room here is to testify on this particular issue, but if you are, you know, I'll have my staff check that in a minute. My intention is to try to keep this for the next 20 minutes or so. We do have Carl Brent in Wasilla, and Carl, can you hear us?
Yes, sir, I can.
Just put your name on the record and give us your testimony, please.
Yes, sir. It's Carl Brett. And my concern for the bill is personal. I had no idea, nor would I have ever known, that Alaska is one of only 10 states that don't recognize these deceased children in civil court, but only in criminal court. But after personally going through a terrible loss like my family has, it was brought to my attention, and the I think it should be fixed. I'd like to see this fixed. Like I stated earlier, I do have personal interest in having these babies recognized in civil court, but more importantly, I'm more interested in getting these bills passed for young couples in the future so that they would have somewhere to turn. I know that there was, you know, unfortunately, I guess the same time testimonies going on at the House side, so I hope that the folks that we all got done on the House side made it over to the Senate side. And I appreciate, when I was down in Juneau a week ago Friday, I appreciate all the support that I got, those people I got to speak with in person down there. So thank you very much.
Carl, thank you very much for taking both committees on. And I don't know that was a great plan of mine to have them both show up on the same day, but appreciate you taking the time in your life. We also have Mary, is it Harned, who is Americans for United in Life, calling off net from Maryland. Mary, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Why don't you go ahead and just put your name and affiliation on the record, and then we'll take your testimony.
Thank you so much. Members of the Alaska Senate Judiciary Committee, my name is Mary Harned, and I am a staff counsel with Americans United for Life. And we are, I'm in Maryland right now, but we are based in D.C. thank you so much for allowing us to testify on behalf of Jackson's Law. Alaska currently bars the cause of action for death of an unborn child unless the child is born alive and dies thereafter. As Senator McGuire stated, this limitation starkly contrasts with Alaska's criminal law, which recognizes that an unborn child at any stage of development may be considered a victim of murder, manslaughter, and criminally negligent homicide. The wrongful death cause of action is intended to correct a flaw in the common law where no cause of action survived a victim's death. Thus, a wrongdoer could escape liability by inflicting injuries so severe that they resulted in the death of his victim. which is a terrible irony that was in the law before wrongful death statutes started to be enacted in the states. 40 states recognize that a parent should be permitted to bring a wrongful death action when his or her unborn child dies in the womb as a result of a third party's criminal action, negligence, malpractice, or production or distribution of an unsafe product. Tragically, Alaskan parents of unborn children who lose their lives because of the wrongful acts or omissions of others cannot receive this justice. These parents unquestionably have interest in the life, health, and well-being of their children. Wrongful behavior which results in the death of an unborn child carries the same social and emotional cost, including bereavement, a loss to society, and the lawlessness and disregard for life which characterizes negligent, harmful, and wrongful behavior. Jackson's Law will extend the protections provided by the state's wrongful death statute to all unborn children in Alaska. We thank you for your leadership in considering this important legislation. Thank you.
Thank you, Mary. Is there any questions for Mary? All right. Thank you, Mary, for taking the time to testify. And once again, for those who are testifying, it was not any purpose of mine to have it go on at the same time as the other committee. So just one of those happy accidents, I guess, in that both of them came up on the same day. John Goodwin is in Anchorage, off-net as well. John, can you hear us?
Can you hear me okay?
Thank you. Put yourself on record and give us your testimony, Mr. Goodwin.
Hi, my name is John Goodwin. I live out in the Wasilla area. And my son is Jackson, who I believe the bill is actually named after. I started pushing this shortly after we lost our son Jackson, my wife and I, Kimberly. I became aware of the born alive rule that Mary kind of just went over just a minute ago. And this common law was created in 1846, over 170 years ago. So I was pretty upset, as you can imagine, a big kick in the gut after losing our kid to find out that the state of Alaska didn't recognize our son. So I started doing some research shortly thereafter and found out that Senator Dyson had actually pushed in 2004, became law in 2006, to protect these unborn children criminally. So I had some hope at that time that maybe it was just an oversight or, you know, something that no one had given any thought to. And I started pushing, calling representatives and senators about 4 or 5 months ago to get to where we're at today. You're going to hear some stories here shortly from other folks who've lost children, unborn children up here. And I'd like to at least at first kind of give an explanation of what it is for us, because what it feels like for us and the pain that we're dealing with, because over and over again, this has rippled through these families. It's not just the immediate parents who are feeling this, or the grandparents, or the uncles and aunts. It ripples through just about every aspect of our lives, including our work and our friends. And nobody means any ill will by when they speak to us, but to hear a good friend refer to your 42-week gestational baby that we're sorry for your miscarriage. Well, our son was 9.5 pounds. He was fully developed, and the only thing that separated him from breathing was the health care that we provided, that was provided that day, and that was a mistake. And you're going to hear of four other family members. You already heard of one from Carl. There are more than that. I've only been able to find the four so far, but these were fully developed children and who aren't here today, who should be here today. They're not fetuses. The pain that people are feeling, Carl happened to call in because the pain is too much for some people. And his son and daughter, who are young and they're in their early 20s, are having to deal with this pain that I'm sure some of you have already felt. The loss of a child is one of the worst pains we can feel in this lifetime. And they're dealing with it in their early 20s. And you can choose to fight or you can choose to flight. And I think in some cases, this pain is so disastrous and so overwhelming that people choose to try to recover by putting it behind them or maybe even compartmentalizing it, which will only affect them later on down the road. And I know this because I've been deployed to Iraq and Afghanistan 6 times. And I've lost quite a few friends over there, We lost one Black Hawk, Alaska Army National Guard. I had four good friends on that over there in 05. And then I got shot down in 05, 06 over there. And so PTSD is something that I've had to deal with in my life for quite some time now. And through the death of Jackson, I've had to relive a lot of that pain. And then dealing with this pain, which happens to be worse than any pain I've experienced overseas. And anyone that I've even known or talked to overseas, this is a very traumatic pain that we're feeling here. So, kind of lost my train of thought here, and I apologize, but this is, as my counselor said, this is the worst pain that you're gonna feel in your life, and it feels that way. So, the reason I wanted to push for this bill was because we've heard over and over again, and we've seen some behavior that if these children aren't recognized by the law, that they never existed, no harm, no foul, and the health care that we're being provided, and you'll hear a few stories a little bit later from now, my hope is that once people realize that they may be held accountable for their actions, that maybe they will take the necessary steps to do the right thing. And that's really what I'm hoping to do here today. And I'm hoping that this law will pass because of this. And it will bring some healing for these people. But as Carl said earlier, it's really for the people out in front of us. And this has been a very interesting situation for three of us because one of the deaths happened almost 3 years ago. And she told me when we spoke that she's coming forward because she doesn't want to see this happen to the next person. Well, my wife Kimberly and I are the next people, so it must have been really hard for her to see who the next people were, and it was us. And I said the same thing. I want to stop this because I don't want it to happen to the next person. Well, that was Carl Brent and his family. So we've got three families in Wasilla who have felt the same exact pain, and we're hoping to stop this from happening in the future. Carl mentioned something personal. Yeah, it does affect him personal. So I wanted to make sure that we're doing this for the right reason, that it wasn't out of our own personal gain, our own personal anger or anguish. So I've been doing a little bit of research, and ironically, I happen to be taking an ethics course in law right now. And one thing I came across, and I'll read it to you, and then I'll be finished today, is if there is no punishment, the community sends out two messages, that it feels no retributive sentiment towards the criminal and no respect for the victim. And a victim who feels no resentment or does not insist on punishment has too little self-esteem. Unfortunately, in this case, the pain is so hard that these people can't come forward. They're putting it behind them. So I'll continue now. A battered wife who doesn't want her spouse punished may have internalized the spouse's claim that she deserves being beaten, and the community feels no moral indignation over the crime being committed against one of its members, fails to stand up for that member, and fails to show the respect for the victim that she deserves. So, from reading this, I felt like we were doing the correct thing here, that we should be, as a community, recognizing the shortcoming in the law. Like we said earlier, there's 40 states that have already switched, and that also gives me resolve, because 40 other states have gone through this process already. Thank you very much.
Mr. Goodwin, thank you very much. Very compelling testimony, and from your personal experience, be assured that a lot of what you said in that quote is something that we've discussed right here on a committee on making sure that the victim is respected to the highest degree possible. Because of time, I'm going to ask the next people to be concise, but I don't want to hold them back. So, Suzanne Hancock, you're in Anchorage, so could you put yourself on record and give us... Oh, by the way, Senator Wilkowski has joined us here about 10 minutes ago, so thank you, Senator Wilkowski. Suzanne, are you there?
Yes. Suzanne Hancock, Anchorage, Alaska.
Thank you.
Well, I'd like to comment on this bill, both from, a concerned citizen position and also a personal position. I was a legal secretary for 13 and a half years, so I do understand the difference between civil and criminal procedures. And also, I was a legislative aide for 6 years, and I understand the process that the legislature goes through. But I'm also part of that ripple effect because I'm good friends with the Wallaces, the Wallace family and the Goodwin family, and I was looking forward to seeing that baby, and to me, it was a baby. Thank you.
Thank you very much for taking the time to call in, Suzanne, and thank you for your work and willing to step up and be part of this conversation. So going to Kimberly Wallace Goodwin. Kimberly, are you able to join us and give us testimony?
Yes, I'm here. Can you hear me?
Yes, fine. Put yourself on the record, Kimberly, and give us your testimony.
For the record, my name is Kimberly Wallace Goodwin, and I'm calling from Wasilla, Alaska. First of all, I'd like to thank Senator McGuire for sponsoring Senate Bill 200, and also thank the committee for hearing this important piece of legislation. And we lost our son, Jackson Wallace Goodwin, on December the 6th, 2012. And as Suzanne mentioned, there's quite the ripple effect. It's not just the parents that are impacted. It's also the grandparents, the aunts, the uncles, the cousins, and the friends and family that go along with that loss. I feel that part of our obligations is to protect those that can't protect themselves and to give voice to the voiceless. And our son Jackson doesn't have a voice, so it's our job to provide that. And I urge you to support Senate Bill 200. And again, I thank you for your time.
Thank you, Kimberly. Thank you for taking time to testify. We'll go next to, is it Layla Raymond?
This is Layla Raymond from Ketchikan, Alaska.
Thank you for coming to our committee and give us your testimony, Layla.
Okay, I'll try to be quick and not so emotional. I'm calling today on behalf of my great-nephew, Tanner Eugene Richards. His mother asked me to call today. Her name is Marina Snover. And they lost Tanner about 16 months ago. She went into the hospital in distress, knowing something was wrong. The baby was just about full term. There was no problems with him once he had been delivered. There was no reason, you know, an autopsy or any other reason that he should have died during that day. When she went into the hospital, she expressed that she was having problems, something was wrong. She spent about 5 hours with a nurse, pleading with the nurse to call the doctor. The doctor was never called. When she went into the hospital, the baby was alive and had a heartbeat, and within that 5 hours, they had lost him. The nurse who was there taking care of my niece had actually admitted to wrongful doing, not being familiar with the equipment that had been brought into the hospital. She had been trained on it, but once it went time for her to use it, she did not feel familiar enough with it and second-guessed the machine and second-guessed herself. And that is the reason that Tanner passed away. That day, I had been called in after they had heard that Tanner had died. And I had been called in by my niece to help her deliver this baby, who every time she would wake up between contractions, she had, you know, the contraction would come on, she would relive the fact that she's delivering a baby who had passed away for no real reason. If there hadn't been the second guessing and the questioning, if this woman had known, hey, I could get in trouble if something goes wrong here, maybe I better call somebody, then this may not have happened. And that's why we're hoping today that you pass this bill to make these people think, hey, I could get in trouble if something goes wrong here. I can't second-guess myself. I need to call somebody, which is what should have been done. And it didn't happen that day, and Tanner died because of that. We did have a funeral for Tanner. People flew in from all over the country, and this little boy had a funeral as if he had lived 80 years. Everybody in our family, everybody in our friends, everyone came all from all over the country to see this little boy off and to be there for his family who was hurting and is still hurting today. My family lived, my niece and nephew lived in Ketchikan when they delivered this baby, and they have moved out into the middle of nowhere so that my niece doesn't have to look at other babies, because she can't deal with it. She cannot cope with it. And because they've moved themselves out there, now they're struggling financially. They're struggling emotionally. You know, they've moved away to where we can't even support them like we would like to, and that's why I'm calling today, to support them and to let you know their story. And we hope very deeply that you pass this bill and help prevent things from like this happening in the future. Thank you.
Thank you, Layla. Thank you very much for giving that deeply emotional and moving testimony. Also, we have April, is it Dishonneau from in Palmer?
Yes, I'm here.
Go ahead and just put yourself on the record and say your last name in case I got it wrong and give us your testimony, April.
Okay, my name's April Dishonneau. I'm from Palmer. And sorry, it's a little emotional, but tomorrow will be my son's birthday. He would have been 3. And instead of having a cake and a party, we are sending balloons to heaven with the rest of my children. I took very good care of myself when I was pregnant. Unfortunately, I was a high risk with high blood pressure all through my pregnancy. I was rushed to the hospital. I was 36 weeks pregnant. I was rushed to the hospital with high blood pressure. They had me on monitors, kept me there for a few days, and then decided, well, your blood pressure is down enough, we're going to send you home. I was dilated to 5 already, and I was just told to go home and go on bed rest. I was home for 1 whole day, and my placenta ruptured, and I was bleeding, hemorrhaging all over the place. My husband found me, had to call an ambulance. By the time we got to the hospital, we were told that the baby wasn't alive. I pleaded for them to give me a C-section or something, to beg them to please don't make me. Sorry, I have an incoming call.
So, April, we're going to move on then. I wanted to give you a second to get that going, but let's go to Sheila Wallace in Kodiak. Sheila, can you hear us okay?
Hi, my name is Sheila Wallace, and I am from Kodiak, and I'm Jackson's grandmother, and I'm one of the ones affected by this. And I would like to urge you all to vote in support of this bill.
Thank you, Sheila. Thank you for taking the time
to call
in. And so very good and compelling reasons and very emotional testimony. And it just shows the value of a life, and hence both in criminal statute and in our the right of civil action, this has been discussed not only for unborn children, but people who are helpless, people who are infirm, people who are not infirm. So I did have a question for the senator who's carrying the bill, and did you get a chance to look up the various different causes that mental, you said it correctly, I had said it wrong, mental state for the way you go through this, it's negligence. So give me those again.
So it's interesting how the bill was crafted. It is meant to coincide with 1141, 150, 160, and 170, which are murder of an unborn child, manslaughter of an unborn child, and criminally negligent homicide of an unborn child. And those mental states are intent to kill, then manslaughter, and that's plain out murder, and then manslaughter is a person commits the crime of manslaughter of an unborn child if under circumstances not amounting to murder the person intentionally, knowingly, or recklessly causes the death of a child, of an unborn child. And then criminally negligent homicide of an unborn child is a person commits the crime of criminally negligent homicide of an unborn child if with criminal negligence the person causes the death of an unborn child. What's interesting is the drafter has, and so you can see in the sponsor statement that, and this is a companion to Representative Gabrielle Ledoux's bill in the House. And so you see the sponsor statement says that's the companion. Now, where it goes in is under the civil section of Alaska statutes, which is Title IX. And Title IX is civil damages. And that particular area that it goes in is 915, and in this case it would add a new section, 915.18. But that the current section is, where can parents sue? Where can parents or guardians sue for injuries to a death of a child? And as it stands right now, parents or guardians can sue for injuries to a death of a child in just two cases. The first is for seduction of a child, and the second is for death or disability of a party. And now this would add a third section, which is for an action for wrongful death of an unborn child. So that's how the two interrelate. And so those are the definitions that I'm putting on record. What I think is interesting here is that how it's describing an action for a wrongful death is it's saying a parent of an unborn child may maintain an action as a plaintiff for the death of an unborn child that was caused by the wrongful act or omission of another. And you've heard a series of those things on the record. I think one thing that would be helpful to bring to the committee on Wednesday would be a better definition of that to have as a part of this, because since we have the civil statute and the criminal statute in two separate areas, what I think we know what we want to do. We know the kinds of actors that we want to get. But since they're not specifically linked up under the intentional, reckless kinds of standards that we have in the criminal code, I think what we want to be real careful then that we do here is probably define wrongful act and omission in the best way that we can. And so that's what I want to bring back to the committee on Wednesday. And I want to say thank you so much to all of the family that came online from across the state on behalf of all of the children out there. I know how hard it is to testify, and that you've done it twice now today, and the chairman didn't, but our offices tried to make it at least as least painful as possible as we could, and we'll try to do that as we move forward, because it's a hard day for you guys to do that, and I thank you for that.
And my intention is to hold this over for further discussion, but is there any questions at this point? Yes, Senator Wilkowski.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I apologize for being late. I was in another meeting. Is there someone from law here, do we know, that will be here on Wednesday maybe?
I thought on Wednesday we would do that. And what I wanted to do is I wanted to allow kind of the testimony from the various different members that had been affected give the testimony today, and then I thought we would then begin our work our way through the bill.
And I'll just
you can throw out the questions.
Probably listening, I'll throw out the questions now, and maybe the sponsor can get back.
Great.
Just the constitutionality of it, in terms of there's always the definition of a fetus and viability, and the definition of unborn child in AS 1181-962 means. I don't know if you read this already, Mr. Chair, a member of the species of Homo sapiens at any stage of development who is carried in the womb. And so I guess a few questions on the constitutionality. I'd be curious what law is to say about, you know, where we're setting that. We're essentially saying a week old, you know, woman gets a test, finds out she's pregnant, she slips and falls on a sidewalk and loses the baby. You now have a wrongful death claim, I assume, and I don't know if that's the intent or not. And then I'd be curious about damages. If you had a situation like that, week-old fetus in the womb, would it pain, suffering? Would you get lifetime earnings? Would you get punitive? I'm just curious what sort of damages would we be looking at in that case. And then have we heard from the doctors? I'd be curious what the doctors and nurses are, because this is going to lead to probably a huge amount of lawsuits against doctors and nurses. They're probably the most affected by this, I'm guessing. And I'd be interested to see if anyone from the medical community has weighed in support or against. And then morning after pill, I don't know if this was asked or not, but I assume that wouldn't apply to morning after pill. I assume it wouldn't apply to women who who drink and they're abusing themselves don't causes harm to the fetus. I assume that doesn't cover it. It looks like, as I read the language, it doesn't, but I just thought, get some legislative history on the record on that, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Senator McGuire.
Thank you, through the chair. As to number one, this bill specifically tracks the criminal bill that was passed in 2006, and so it does have the definition of unborn child that was given in 1181-900, and you're correct, it does not separate by trimesters. And so the ability to, for a woman who is choosing to give life to her baby and has chosen to go forward with her pregnancy, would have the ability to claim that that life inside of her that went away as a result of someone's intentional or negligent act that ended that life, would have an ability to make a claim about that. That's number one. And what law would have to say about the constitutionality, that would be their opinion, but it would be my opinion that it would apply. With respect to damages, I would suspect that it would be up to the lawyers to argue about that, and because we've never had this particular cause of action, it's going to be unique in that sense. My suspicion is that it's more to do with the parents' loss and their pain and suffering, as opposed to the potential for the child's life at 1 week of development. But we could probably have law talk a little bit about that. But you've heard from some of the folks online today about that law, that lifetime loss, and the inability to make them whole, but at least some effort to try. I think the doctors and nurses argument is very valid and an important one to bring into the conversation. And then finally, with respect to the morning after pill or any other piece on abortion that's specifically exempted in the bill, there as it was drafted, and so is any act of a pregnant woman against herself.
Thank you.
So one other question, Senator McGuire, since 40 other states have done this, there might be a record of suits that would be able to categorize some of those questions for you. So, giving us some examples of how that has been handled. Okay, I'm going to lay Senate Bill 200 aside. Certainly we'll have Department of Law here to talk about it. As you can see from the testimony, you're talking about real lives, and I want to keep the discussion with that context in mind, because when we start talking about the other issues, it gets a little I don't know how to describe law sometimes can get rather bland, but I will just keep the victimization in mind. So with that, we're going to lay aside that, and I'm about 10 minutes off where I wanted to be, but I thought that was a worthwhile discussion. Thank you, Senator. At this point, I'm going to bring up Senate Bill 176, which I think a lot of people came to testify on today. So if I could get the sign-up list for that, what I'm going to do is I'm going to have the bill sponsor come forward, who's actually, I'm the bill sponsor, but the carrier in my office is Hans Rodvig, and I'm going to ask him to come up, and I'm going to ask Chad Hutchison, who has been helping him think through some of the legal aspects of it. I thought if they could come up and give me the first 10 or 12 minutes introduction, because I know that there has been some talk of a CS, and for those who are wanting to hear the testimony, I think it would be only proper if you heard if there was going to be some potential changes to it. Maybe that might either answer some of your testimony questions or give you something other to testify on. So, Mr. Rodvig.
For the record, my name is Hans Rodvig, intern to Senator Coghill. Thank you, Senate Judiciary Committee, for having me here again today. I intend for my remarks to be short, given that I know there's a lot of public testimony and we want ample time for that. Since our last hearing, we've been considering the concerns of the university and are working on ways to properly balance public safety, the public safety interest, and the two individual fundamental rights, those being the right to keep and bear arms and the right to privacy guaranteed in our state constitution. Our hope is by Wednesday, given the legal drafting aspects, we all know they're busy over there, we hope to have a CS for the committee that will narrow the focus of the bill down to precisely focus on concealed carry. This will help diffuse some of the concerns and some of the notions about 16-year-olds carrying long guns on campus. We wanted to let it stand for the record that it was never our intent, nor ever or ever will be, to have open carry on campus. We have absolutely no interest in that, and we would like this bill to specifically focus on concealed carry. We're reasonable, open-minded, and just concerned about public safety as anybody else. But as we've seen throughout the country, when law-abiding citizens are rendered defenseless and prohibited from carrying firearms in self-defense, deranged lunatics wreak havoc upon innocent life. Senate Bill 176 will provide law-abiding adults who are on our public campuses the same form of defense they have throughout the rest of Alaska. At this point, I don't want to go into addressing some of the points or the other points made by the university. Like I said, we hope to have a CS before the committee that we adequately feels address it, or that we adequately feel addresses the public safety concerns brought to us by the university, and also balances and enables the peaceable exercise of law-abiding citizens, enables them to exercise their fundamental rights. So that concludes my remarks for today, and with that, I'll turn it over to Chad.
Sir, Mr. Hutchison, and thank you very much, Hans. So, and I do have a lot of people testify, so as brief as you can get.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Chad Hutchison. I am on the staff for Senator Coghill. I'm also an attorney. A little bit of brief background. I am a UAF alumni. I did get a bachelor in business administration. I lived up on campus for 4 years. I'm passionate about the university. I frequently deal with it even now. I'm part of the alumni board. I have a tremendous amount of respect for Vice Chancellor Serega and Chancellor Rogers up in Fairbanks. I consider many of the administration my friends, frankly, including the attorney that drafted the University of Alaska memorandum that we've come to review, and today I hope to give some analysis on. As Mr. Rodvik stated, the intent of SB 176 was specifically focused toward concealed carry. We've taken the analysis provided by the university and hope to provide a CS that further delineates that point. Whenever you're talking about concealed carry, there's two fundamental rights that are automatically brought to the forefront. One is the fundamental right to privacy. The other is the fundamental right to keep and bear arms. In fact, Alaska is one of the few states that has that fundamental right to privacy built into their constitution. So whenever you're talking about fundamental rights, it's the standard used by the court system is strict scrutiny, which means that in order to have a restriction on that fundamental right, the University of Alaska has to show that their restriction is necessary to a compelling state interest. And then beyond that, they also have to show that their restriction is the least restrictive alternative. So that's the template upon which we're operating in. And you can see by reviewing the University of Alaska analysis is they do start to touch on that point at one point in time. And you can see that some of the drafters of the Board of Regents policy actually touch on it and incorporate it, because they specifically state in 0209-020D, quoting that the university's compelling interest is what is at stake. So what does that all mean? I'd like to paraphrase the standard set forth in the 2007 State versus Planned Parenthood case. If the individual right proves to be fundamental, which when we're talking about the right to privacy and the right to keep and bear arms, and they certainly qualify to that category, then strict scrutiny applies, and the University of Alaska policy can only withstand constitutional scrutiny if they provide the least restrictive alternative. So that's the question that's going to come up as representatives from Alaska, the University of Alaska, come forward. Have they considered the least restrictive alternative? Everybody acknowledges that the university has a compelling interest in making sure that the public safety and the safety of the students is at the forefront. Nobody is going to debate that point. But they have to do the second part of the analysis, and if they are going to restrict firearms on campus, is it the least restrictive alternative? And I'll submit, I've come up with a list. I've yet to hear if those least restrictive alternatives have come to the forefront. But I do have a few suggestions that at least maybe need to be in the conversation or maybe need to be considered. Have training courses been considered? Mr. Rodvik and I have both looked at the model used down in Utah, where the same issue came to the forefront, where concealed carry was an issue. The University of Utah actually challenged that policy, and the Supreme Court upheld that concealed carry can occur on college campuses. Some of the ideas that are out there are, can you have a one-time, 4-hour concealed carry safety class and get a card? Can you have some sort of permit related to, concealed handguns, much like you have a University of Alaska parking permit? If you go through that safety course and you have reassurances that you understand storing the firearm, you have knowledge about it, you've used it in operation, you have some sort of proof to the university's content. Is that qualified enough? Is that something that the University of Alaska can consider? So that would be our position as to if the University of Alaska wants to restrict firearms. They need to make sure they're doing it in a constitutional manner, and it has to be as least restrictive as possible. And that's a question that needs to be answered, and the burden is on the University of Alaska to show that they're indeed creating a policy that is indeed least restrictive considering the alternatives. So if anybody has any questions, I'd be happy
to answer. I just wanted you to give the testimony. Since you can appear before us at any time, and these students and the people called in can't, I would like to get to testimony and let as much testimony as I can into the day. And so I really appreciate that. I have, if you don't mind, I will do that, committee members. I have Bob Bird in Nikiski, who was the first one on the list, and then I'm going to go to one of the room members. We have Drew, is it Lamish? Lamish. Why don't you two vacate the seat, and if I can have Drew from UAA, I think, is here. Go ahead and take the seat, and I'll have Mr. Bird give his testimony first, and then you'll be the next one up. So, Bob Bird, can you hear us?
Thank you, Senator Coghill. Yep. Just to introduce myself, Bob Bird. I'm a public. I've been a public school teacher on a secondary level for 40 years, 36 of them in Alaska. It's been 6 times, I believe, an adjunct instructor at the local community college, and I take classes there myself very frequently, too many times to count in the last 35 years, most recently in this last fall. I feel insulted every time I come to an entrance there and it says that weapons aren't permitted on campus. I do read the Alaska Constitution. There are no exceptions as to what limits there are on the right to keep and bear arms, especially as amended. It says the individual right to keep and bear arms shall not be denied or infringed by the state or a political subdivision of the state. And then at that point, if the Board of Regents would like to have it amended to have whatever exceptions they want in there, I think that's where they need to take their fight. I just heard your aide said that he won't debate the fact that everyone wants this, that the UA system has the right or the need to protect everybody. But their mission is to educate, not to protect. I'll protect myself. Thank you very much, because the issue of protection soon morphs into restriction. I would say that because SB 176 is still a work in progress and we're really not sure what we've got hold of right now, I would suggest in this very limited testimony that the UA can do what it wants. What the legislature should do is to draft a bill that will defend students who refuse to comply with the university's noncompliance. And how that, what form that might take is where I think the legislature ought to go with it. In other words, the university is in noncompliance. I consider a person who might have a concealed weapon in their pocket, on their in their backpack or something like that, is going to be snitched on by somebody who gets a glimpse of it, and then there's going to be some sort of administrative penalties to people who are frankly quite responsible. And I don't need to tell anybody that we have a gun-free zone really means a criminal enabling zone, and I would like very much to make sure that I can defend myself anywhere in this state with whatever restrictions the legislature might constitutionally apply. And thank you very much.
Thank you, Bob. Thank you very much. That was very concise, and you're right, it is a work in progress, and so we'll look forward to further comment on others. So, Drew, go ahead and put yourself on the record and give us your testimony, please.
My name is Drew Limish. I'm the president of the Union of Students at the University of Alaska Anchorage. I'm here today to oppose SB 176. This bill is fixing something that is not broken and putting every single person that steps foot on campus at risk. As a student, I do not feel secure sitting next to somebody with a firearm. This bill is allowing anyone to walk into my office with a gun. And I encourage you all to ask yourself, is it constitutional for us not to be allowed to walk into your office with a gun? And do you feel safe if somebody walks into your office with a gun? And there's over 10,000 people on my campus every day that would be allowed to walk into my office with a gun. There's not 10,000 people that come through the legislative office building that would have that same right. And I think if you make it right for people to carry guns on campus, you should also make it right for people to carry guns into your office. This bill gets in the way of university police responding to an at-risk student, not only at-risk to himself, but every single student around them. So please do not pass this piece of legislation.
Drew, thank you for taking time to come testify. And I know you're joined by some good folks, and I appreciate everybody coming by. I'm going to work through these as fast as I can. Matthew Kirby is, I think, in California, and I just wanted to give you 2 minutes, Matthew, but then I'm going to go back to Alaska. So, Matthew, are you on?
Sure. My name is Matthew Kirby, and I'm the West Coast Regional Director for the National Grassroots Organization Students for Concealed Carry. I'm from Louisiana, but I'm currently a graduate student in La Mirada, California, and for what it's worth, I'm a former Marine infantryman who's deployed both to Iraq and Afghanistan. And I thank the committee for the opportunity to testify in favor of the present bill. I wish to express my gratitude and extend my support for SB 176, the passage of which would compel the University of Alaska to comply with Alaska state law regarding the constitutionally protected right of citizens to keep and bear arms. It's my earnest desire, as well as that of the tens of thousands of members that comprise Students for Concealed Carry, to see the nationwide adoption of legal provisions that protect the ability of ordinary citizens to defend themselves in any circumstances in which their lives may be threatened. It's an unfortunate fact that university campuses have historically been and are in principle vulnerable to attack by malicious individuals, the collective havoc wrought by such heinous crimes being utterly inestimable. And while no law can make certain the safety of citizens in every circumstance, the purpose of the law is not to realize the ideal, but rather to enact provisions codifying the just and prudent exercise of those rights guaranteed first by our Creator and second by our Constitution. And it's my firm opinion that SB 176 is indeed both a prudent and a morally necessary addition to Alaskan law. With regard to the former, that is the bill's practicality, SB 176 is consistent with the wide body of positive evidence that average citizens can be trusted to use their firearms responsibly in self-defense scenarios. A 1997 study by University of Maryland senior research scientist John Watts and University of Georgia professor David Mustard called Crime, Deterrence, and Right to Carry Concealed Handguns, which is in the Journal of Legal Studies, as well as studies by engineering statistician William Sturdivant and various state agencies, have shown that concealed handgun license holders are 5 times less likely than non-license holders to commit violent crimes. The bill is, in addition, consistent with the negative evidence, that is, the fact that the 206 college and university campuses nationwide that allow students and faculty to carry concealed weapons there's not been any discernible increase in incidents of violence as a result of such provisions. And
Matthew,
state laws of both Utah and Colorado have for several years now. Yes, sorry.
Do you have that written down?
I do.
If you wouldn't mind sending that to committee, I've got a whole room full of people chomping at the bit to testify. And if you could send that to me, I'll put it on our basis record so that people can see your position and some of your best arguments, if you wouldn't mind, Matthew.
Sure, just whatever is most efficient for you guys.
Thank you very much.
I appreciate the opportunity to testify. Thank you.
All right. Why don't I have, in the room, I have Younger, Oliver, and Victoria Daniels. If you would come to the front, if you're willing to testify, and then what I'll do is I have... John Aspens in Fairbanks right now. John, can you hear me? John Aspens, Fairbanks? Okay.
This is John Aspens. Can you hear me?
Oh, thank you. I said it wrong. Thanks for correcting me. Go ahead and put your name on the record and give us your testimony, John.
Yeah, my name is John Aspinus, Fairbanks, Alaska. I'm a retired professor of engineering at UAF, and I've taught at UAF since 1978. I am speaking against this Senate Bill 176 that would allow unrestricted carry of firearms on University of Alaska campuses for the following reasons. UAF has an armed police force. There is little crime on campus. Many high school age and younger students are on campus year-round taking courses or enrolled in summer programs and other youth-related activities. The university acts in a parental role. Many college-age students are still immature and live in a stressful environment. There will be unintended consequences such as accidents or crimes committed in the heat of passion, and there is no compelling reason to allow unrestricted, or for that matter, which seems to be the case now, under discussion, concealed carry firearms on the UA campuses. And so again, I urge that unrestricted firearms or concealed carry firearms continue not be allowed on UA campuses. Thank you for considering my testimony.
John, thank you for being concise. You made your point. You got made it very well, and thank you very much. So we have Younger, Oliver, put yourself on record. And next up in Fairbanks, I'll have Lance Roberts, so get ready. After we have Victoria Daniels, so Younger.
Hi, thank you. My name is Younger Oliver. I'm a student at UAA. I'm here in opposition of SB 176. The current policies we have are effective, and they have been effective since they've been implemented. And the Board of Regents is the university's governing body, and they are most in tune with the happenings on the UA campuses, and so I think that they should be able to regulate what happens on those campuses, as they are the ones that know the most about them. UAA is all campuses. It's a stressful environment, and professors and staff have received threats from students, and I work on campus. I have received threats from students, and I think it would be a bad idea to legally allow students to bring weapons to campus, and it could just cause bad things to happen. We should be focusing on preventing crime from happening on campus, and currently, if I see a student with a weapon on campus, I would be able to call our police department and, you know, report this student and say, you know, they are here potentially going to cause harm to someone. If SB 176 gets passed, if I do happen to see someone with a weapon on campus, I will not be able to do anything, nor will our police department, until they actually commit the crime. So we also have child care facilities on campus, and they take the children across all of the buildings, and I do not think it's a good idea to legally allow weapons near children of a very young age. So please review SB 176, and please do not pass this piece of legislation. Thank you.
Younger, once again, thank you for being concise, made your point. I think state law for the child care facilities would still stand, but in any case, points well taken. You're taking up somebody else's time.
Oh.
Victoria, you're up, and then Lance, you're going to be after Victoria. So, Victoria, put yourself on record. Move that microphone over there, please. Thank you very much.
My name is Victoria Daniels. I am currently here in Juneau at UAS, and I actually serve as a senator on our student government. I've been reaching out to the students, staff, and faculty concerning SB 176, and a majority of the groups have spoken out against the bill. They feel that if their bill were to be passed and concealed weapons were to be allowed on campus, there would be a safety issue. The primary priority for the school is education and securing a safe and welcoming environment to do so. By allowing guns on campuses, this shifts the focus to safety. And we also, on the campus, we do host students from kindergarten through 12th grade, so that would also be a concern. Students are concerned about housing, especially since right now we do have at housing state or the university, they have to be stored in a locked up facility, and there's concerns of alcohol and drugs being in housing. So the coalition of student leaders have also took a stance against it, and our student government has also taken a stance. So we urge you to consider those views when you take your vote. So thank you for your time.
Victoria, thank you very much. Definitely under consideration. So Lance Roberts in Fairbanks.
This is Lance. Can you hear me?
Yes. Go ahead and put yourself on the record. Lance, give us your testimony.
Lance Roberts from Fairbanks. For 30 years, I've been going to the university up through last year. I've gotten 3 degrees, and most of that time has been going part-time while I work, so therefore I spent much more time up there than you think working on 3 degrees. And I thought that the last, the statement before last, where they said that the policies were effective, was completely off base. They've actually been completely ineffective. What they've been effective to do is to teach students that it's okay for people to take away their constitutional rights, that the Constitution is a meaningless document, and that they should be going into places and have their rights stripped from them, that only the bad guys should be able to do anything, and that they should wait for somebody else to come along to defend them instead of defending themselves. We shouldn't be teaching fear in our school system. We should be educating them to defend themselves and to stand up for their neighbor. When this issue came in front of the borough assembly a few years ago, because people were coming in and they were carrying weapons into assembly chambers, which is perfectly legal in Fairbanks, people were getting upset, so a few assembly members, and there was a newspaper article on it, and I wanted to, and I did, point out to them that you're the safest place you can be because there are good men that are armed and ready to defend you. There's nothing more erroneous than believing that the police are going to be wherever they need to be. They're just not omnipotent. They're not able to defend you. Good people armed is the best way, and the way that we've historically defended ourselves in this country. And hundreds of thousands, millions of incidents every year happen where people are defending themselves because they're armed. I also want to address the point that the president made last week and was made again by the retired professor today about the K-12 and how they walk through the campuses and all that. But realize that K-12, those are students throughout the entire community that is armed, just like we're talking about now. We're not extending special rights to those students. We're giving them the same rights they already have in the rest of the community. And those K-12 students are walking through the rest of our community, and we don't have any special problem because of it. So please, I encourage you to advance this bill, and while I would like it to be fully constitutional, because they're violating the Constitution now and have it apply to all forms of carry, I am just fine if it does, ends up getting restricted to concealed carry, to at least get one more step of freedom for those students so they can learn what it means to be responsible. You become responsible by being given responsibility and exercising that appropriately. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Lance, and thank you for taking the time to come up to testify. And I have a whole room full of people here, so I'm going to ask two more. Callie, is it Cornerton? And then Laura Vess, if you would come up and take a seat. And then I have one in Anchorage, and then I'm going to go back up to Fairbanks LIO to Janelle Manchester. Anchorage will be Chuck Green, so just get yourself ready after. That's kind of the lineup I'm going at this point. So right now we have Callie.
Hi, for the record, my name is Callie Connerton. I am a senator at UAS. Thank you for allowing me to speak today. I'm talking to you on behalf of the students of the University of Alaska. I'm here to discuss SB 176 and the students' views on it. When the coalition of student leaders who represent the campuses statewide have discussed the bill with the students, the majority have been against it, over 70%. As a coalition, we are opposed to the bill. We do not believe it's beneficial to our students, nor our faculty, staff, or the campuses. The students do not believe it is necessary. They believe it's not the place for guns, as it is a place of education. They also find it scary, as one can carry a gun without permits or training in the state of Alaska. Many families are on campus, and they do not feel safe bringing their children to a campus with weapons allowed as concealed carry, as well as both UAA and UAF have daycare facilities on campus. This bill would take away the university's right to try and help a student if they are in fear of that student lashing out, becoming violent, depressed, or also taking out a bad grade on others, as it is a stressful environment. The University of Alaska is committed to the safety of its students, staff, and visitors. I'm asking you to do the same. I stand behind the University of Alaska, and I stand behind the student government at UAS and the Coalition of Student Leaders, as they all do not believe that this bill should be passed. Thank you.
Kelly, thank you very much. I noticed you have it written. Is that something you feel comfortable turning into the committee, and I can post it on the record?
Yes, of course.
Thank you very much. And I'm going to go get Laura Ness, I'm sorry. And if you could be brief, but we certainly don't want to thwart your opportunity. And then we'll go to Fairbanks to, is it Janelle Manchester? So go ahead, Laura.
Thank you. My name is Dr. Laura Vess. I am a resident of Juneau. I am also an assistant professor of sociology at the University of Alaska Southeast. I am a faculty member strongly opposed to Senate Bill 176. I am not anti-gun ownership or use. However, institutions of higher education are not the appropriate setting to wage a battle over rights to possess firearms. Many of my students are struggling to find their adult identity and develop a sense of self. This does not need to be complicated by adding another potentially explosive variable into their transition from adolescence to adulthood. Proponents of gun presence on university campuses often invoke the Virginia Tech shootings as evidence of the need to allow armed students, staff, and faculty. I am a graduate of Virginia Tech. I have friends and former professors who are on campus, researching and teaching the day of the shootings. I could not get in touch with them, and I watched the news anxiously for updates. I was also a resident advisor while at Virginia Tech. In fact, for a year, I lived and worked in West Ambler Johnson in the actual dorm room where two people were killed. This act of gun violence was horrific. However, none of this reversed my position regarding firearms on college campuses. Instead, it made me, and it should have made others, aware of the complexity of the factors that shape criminal action. My concern is that the legislative response with this bill is not reflective of the systematic understanding of the roots of violence on university campuses. Instead, I am concerned that this bill is ideologically driven with a narrow conceptualization of freedom and liberty that has nothing to do with the operations and needs of Alaska's universities or of the safety of the thousands of students, faculty, staff, visitors, and minors who are on Alaskan campuses on any given day. Changing the bill to conceal carry does not change my mind or alleviate my concerns, even if suggesting a four-hour safety course. This is less time than I expect students to study for an exam, and their life and the lives of others does not depend on passing that exam. I strongly support the University of Alaska Board of Regents in their opposition to Senate Bill 176. And I strongly urge you to do the same.
Thank you, Doctor, and thanks for taking the time to come to the committee. If you want to submit that, we'll make sure that gets on the public record as well.
Well, thank you.
Thank you. Is it Janelle Manchester in Fairbanks?
Hello?
Janelle, we can hear you, so put yourself on the record and give us your testimony, please.
For the record, my name is Janelle Manchester. I am a geology student at the University of Alaska Fairbanks, and I'm here to testify against SB 176. I believe that the current policies and regulations enacted by the Board of Regents are more than adequate to safely regulate firearms on campus. There are many facets to this discussion, but given the short time, I'd like to focus on the mental health concerns. Alaska has some of the highest suicide by firearm rates in the United States. In 2012, a man committed suicide in the Rasmussen Library using a firearm, so this is not an unknown concern on campus. SB 176 potentially takes away UA's ability to proactively act against depressed individuals. While I hope that the dorms and living/communal areas will be restricted areas, if not, there will be increased access to firearms by a potentially highly stressed and or volatile population. In a paper titled Firearms and Suicides in the United States from the International Review of Law and Economics, they find that there is a strong positive effect of gun prevalence on suicide. SB 176 will increase access to firearms on campus, and to summarize, I believe the increased access to firearms will not be a benefit to the students on campus, especially not the mentally ill. Thank you.
Janelle, thank you for being concise. I think you certainly made your point, and we really appreciate you taking the time to listen in and be a part of the testimony. For those listening who may not make it to the end of the committee, one of the reasons I got in the legislature was I came to testify, took time off of my life. It cost me a lot of money. I never got to testify, so I am deeply sympathetic, believe me. Chuck Green in Anchorage, you're also there to testify. Chuck, put yourself on the record and give us your testimony.
Yes, this is Chuck Green. I'm representing the Second Amendment Task Force, and I'll not echo all the testimony from Winslow except to say that we agreed with most of it. I'd like to address a few additional things. Somebody brought up the history of what we did back in 2010. We've been involved in this issue since 2009, and we worked in conjunction with the SCC and considered several avenues when we decided to proceed with a demonstration on campus in the spring of 2010, if I recall correctly. We wanted to create an incident so we could gain an audience with the Board of Regents or start a legal action. We had an administrative hearing with representatives of the university and decided to try to go through the university channels after meeting to see if we could remedy the situation. Hans has a couple of documents that I sent him regarding that. We have been unsuccessful in reasoning with the board. Our next move was to ask a legislator to sponsor legislation similar to SB 176. However, YAL with College Republicans and the Political Science Association beat us to it, and my hat's off to these young adults. They have the full weight of our network behind them, and we're not going to go away anytime soon. UA has had ample opportunity to change their policy and refused. And I will add that the university is not above the law. Now, there's been several comments regarding the responsibility of youth, and I'd like to address that. I'm a non-current NRA certified instructor, and I've worked with kids as young as 8 years old teaching them to shoot. I was struck by the seriousness with which they approached the subject. Frankly, I thought they were too young, but most instinctively perceived the gravity of what we were doing and displayed a maturity I didn't expect. In the bush, kids often carry guns to school, and a principal and administrator I know from the Kuskokwim district told me he had kids unload and stack their guns in the corner when they got to school. And we're talking about middle and high school kids here. I heard concerns about accidents. That's a perfectly valid concern, but I suggest that motor vehicles are much more dangerous than we allow 16-year-olds to drive. A little bit about armed citizens. I have an old book sitting here that's called The Armed Citizen by the NRA that from 1978 to 1989 has 196 pages of incidents of citizens stopping violence. And there's about 12 incidents per page. And that's just the incidents that made the newspapers. There are estimates of as many as 2 million crimes a year stopped by armed citizens. Luby's Cafe, Sandy Hook, Columbine, Virginia Tech all could have been stopped by an armed citizen.
Hey, Chuck, do you have
Colorado?
Chuck, do you have that in writing? I would love to be able to pass that out to the committees, and I'm going to have to move on so that I can get some of these other people to testify. Is that something you can get to us so that I can pass it out?
Sure, I can send you my notes.
I would greatly appreciate that. You can wrap up, though.
Okay, I don't have much left. Just there was a young vet at the Aurora shooting sitting in the second row, according to what I've been told, that left his gun in the car and he could have stopped the incident. And if you know of Evan Ramsey, the Bethel shooter, mm-hmm. I don't know if you know that he previously attempted a school shooting at a village 8 miles upriver from Antioch and was by a school district employee, an armed employee. And they've talked about drugs and other things, but, you know, federal law already covers mental patients from owning weapons, and that's something to consider in this, too. So, anyway, I hope you support this bill, and because an individual shouldn't have to request permission to exercise their rights. And thank you for your time.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much. In the room here, I would like to invite up David Noon and Tasha Hansen. If you want to go ahead and come on up, and I will get to you. And I have Courtney Enright in Fairbanks. Courtney, are you able to get to the phone at this point?
Yes.
Put yourself on record and give us your testimony while we get situated here in committee. Thank you.
All right. Good afternoon. My name, for the record, is Courtney Enright, and I am the student regent. First off, I'd like to start by saying that I'm not speaking on the behest of the Board of Regents, but rather on behalf of the 34,000 students in the University of Alaska system that I have the privilege to statutorily represent. I have received an absolute outcry of student responses to Senate Bill 176, and I can state that about 70% of them do not support the bill as written. The reasons are varied, and the messages have been on par, so I'm just going to give you the summary of all the concerns that I've received from a very large source. And that's the biggest one is the protection of the learning environment. A professor can currently remove a student from the learning environment if they're distracting for any reason, cell phone use, whatnot, and the bill currently as written does not necessarily allow a professor the ability to remove a student who is using a weapon in a inappropriate way or distracting from the class. The high suicide rates, the consumptions of alcohol and other mind-altering substances, particularly that we have a high-density space and environment, and we have very little way to enforce or look at if a student has consumed a large amount of alcohol or any sort of mind-altering substance that we don't allow people to use weapons with at the same time. Also, the university is an incredibly high-stress environment at times, and people act differently under incidences of pressure and stress. And finally, most of the rest of the concerns can be summed up really in what I call the wisdom of 20-somethings. We make mistakes, we're learning, we're young, and the university is a fairly safe environment in which to make those mistakes. So we have some overall concerns about why we would want to allow an increased access to a tool that could really allow us to make those mistakes in a way that would haunt us for the rest of our lives or potentially shorten our lives. And I'll send you the full written record, but I'll be happy to answer any questions you have. Other than that, just thank you for your time and consideration.
Courtney, thank you very much. Very articulate. And please do send in copies of your testimony, and we'll make sure that that gets on the basis record. So with us in room, and by the way, the next two are going to be in front of us. And then just to give you an idea, Scott Gellerman in Anchorage will be up after these two. So we have David.
Hi, greetings. My name is David Noon. I'm an associate professor of American history and chair of the social science department at the University of Alaska Southeast. As an educator, I can think of very few things more detrimental to the university mission and to my mission as a teacher than SB 176, which promises to raise and not diminish the likelihood that gun violence will occur on our classrooms, in our dormitories, our office suites and libraries, our sports facilities and parking lots. As the previous speaker alluded to, there are a great many compelling reasons to limit the availability of firearms on our campuses. Young people between the ages of 18 and 24, and there are a lot of them in this room, are vastly more likely than other age cohorts to drink excessively. They're vastly more likely to suffer from mental illnesses. They're vastly more likely to commit gun crimes, violent gun crimes, than others. We have horrific episodes like what took place at Virginia Tech in 2007 in Northern Illinois the following year. But the truth of the matter is that college campuses are among the safest places for people between those ages to gather. Justice Department statistics bear this out. The likelihood of being a victim of a violent crime is roughly 20% less on a college campus than elsewhere. And this is the case for students who live on campuses. 7 out of 8 students in universities who are victims of violent crimes are victimized off campus 90% of the violence committed against college students as a whole takes place off campus. This is, you know, the logic of this bill is, in some sense, to make our universities safer. I think we've got something here that involves an ideological search for a solution that lacks an empirical problem that can be identified. I think it's something we can debate whether students and employees bearing arms are going to be somehow uniquely capable of defending themselves against all kinds of spectacular attacks that are presumably taking place across our university system. But with all due respect to the colleagues and the students that I've had in 20 years of teaching in university settings, there is not a single one of them that I would trust with my safety in a stressful, violent situation. And to do so with the approval of legislators in this room, it doesn't encourage me at all. I don't trust my employers on every question, but I do trust them to design policies that allow me to teach my students in the safest possible environment. I don't trust an assembly of legislators to design or eradicate those same policies. I urge you to defeat this bill.
Thanks for taking the time to come testify, David.
Let me ask a question.
Senator Dyson?
My question will sound pejorative, and it probably is a bit, but you do trust legislators and administration to dictate which of the Bill of Rights will be abridged?
Certainly, but I also trust the Board of Regents, who, as several people have already testified, are very familiar with the lives of students and the working lives of faculty and staff to design policies that keep everyone safe.
I would only encourage that I don't get into the debate, because I got two more people at least I wanted to get to testify so that I didn't start down that road. So I've already stopped one legislator. So next up we have Tasha, who thanks for coming in, Tasha.
Thanks for having me. Thank you for having me. For those of you that can't see me, number one, my name is Tasha Hansen. I'm a student at UAS. I'm here of my own accord. This is kind of an interesting subject for me because the way the school requires everything, I'm not going to read all my notes because it would take too long. I'll just get the high points. They basically say, yep, you can drive onto campus, lock up in the car, and come into class without a firearm. Well, the problem is, being in a wheelchair, I don't have a I don't have a car that I can lock it up in. I've tried a lot of ways to meet them in the middle, and I see that this law kind of gets to a point where it gets to the personal choice of the person being, you know, okay, do I want to do this? Not so much that it's going to make every person carry, which a lot of the people I have heard testify, it sounds like they think that every person is going to run out, buy a gun, and carry it at school. In reality, I think there might be a dozen overall that decide to carry, aside from our veterans that we have. Our veterans might decide on a higher percentage level, I'm not sure. But being a member of the disabled community, depending on the year, you can go from a very low percentage, higher than a functional person, up to as much as 80% higher risk of being a victim of a violent assault. What scares me is I've already been stalked on our local campus. When I went to an administrator, I was informed we don't even have security right now. We don't have security at the dorms. Who do I have to turn to? You know, I can only go as fast as my wheelchair will run. You know, who do I have right this second? I've talked to police officers. They've gone, yeah, we have four cars on duty at any one time except for a two-hour period on Friday night. So if I don't have the school I can turn to, if I don't have the police department that has an adequate amount of officers on duty, I have to turn to myself to protect me. I don't see that there's really another way to... I mean, being gone through the things I've gone through, and including the stalking incident, which did happen on campus,
So, Tasha, did you bring a written testimony?
I did.
If you wouldn't mind, I'd like to have that, and I'd also scan that and put that on the record, if you don't mind.
Why I was just trying to hit high points, because I knew we were kind of on a time crunch.
I know, and I'm going to run this committee over 2 minutes to get the last person that I said that I would let him on, Scott Gellerman in Anchorage. And, Scott, and then I'm going to leave several people stranded.
I appreciate you letting me talk.
Thank you very much, Tasha. I'm really glad you came. Scott, why don't you, by the way, my intention is not to close public testimony at this point. So, Scott, you got 2 minutes.
All right. Greetings and salutations to my honored legislators and others in attendance. I'm Scott Gellerman, residing in Anchorage, Alaska, and I'm calling to offer my support for SB 176. I've read both the proposed bill and the sponsor statement, and I'm in full agreement with both of those, the constitutionality of which should be sufficient grounds for passage of this bill. That being said, I believe most of the opposition to this bill that I've heard, especially today, that is unsafe, unlawful, and irresponsible carry, is unfounded and seems to me to be based upon fear and anxiety rather than factual data or statistics. The fact is that the majority of individuals who would choose to carry on campus, I believe, if this bill becomes law, are already participating in lawful and responsible carry off campus. Furthermore, the opposition based upon open carry and the anxiety and fear that those actions would cause amongst people in general is also unfounded and, according to Mr. Hans Rodvik's prior testimony, has nonetheless been addressed. So in short, I don't anticipate there'd be any noticeable or detectable change in day-to-day activities on campus should this law be enacted. Perhaps there may be a few additional smiling faces as those who appreciate liberty, the rule of law, and rights afforded us by our Constitution finally have the legal authority to protect themselves and exercise their rights while on the University of Alaska property. So in closing, let's not forget that the safest place in America is solitary confinement at Leavenworth. This bill is about rights, not about misguided fear. Thanks a lot for taking my testimony.
Thank you very much. Thank you all for showing up to testify. I really appreciate I did leave some people stranded. My apologies. I've kept the committee beyond their normal hour, and they've got other committees to go to. So my intention is not to close public testimony. We will have this back before us again and probably debating a CS, probably be bringing in other testimony too. So thank you very much. Thank you all for coming to testify in committee, and this committee is adjourned at 3:04.